Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE, and on this podcast, we feature a presentation from the ELI 2012 conference. The speaker is Catherine Casserly, CEO for Creative Commons. Her presentation is entitled, Sharing and Protecting Ideas and Knowledge in the 21st Century.
Thank you very much. So let's begin by thinking about the world in which we live and how we live and interact every day. Right now, parts of our world are very private. We have houses that we keep private. We have cars we might keep private, but sometimes we might take public transportation. Our offices are private, but there are common spaces in which we work. And sometimes we keep documents private, and other times we share documents for input and collaboration. And the world in which we live has changed dramatically over the past 20, 30, 40 years, clearly. Things have evolved. Things have shifted. And in that shifting, we've now created a new ecosystem for how we live. And particularly if we think about how we live against how our children live and how our grandchildren will live, the world is very, very different. I have two teenage sons. One son is now applying to colleges and has all his applications in, and he just can't understand the system that I used when I applied to colleges quite a long time ago, where I had to type out every application and hand carry the transcript and make sure it was mailed. The world is very different. And the digital natives today are living in a very different world from what we did in the past. And we know, as we think about it, and all of you who are in public institutions and think about education and the greater benefit of education, know that knowledge is a public good. And this has been a long history of how we've carried knowledge throughout the traditions, throughout the decades, throughout the millenniums. And we also know that public goods should be freely shared. And so how does this blending of private and public and this new day of openness and the internet, how does this blend all together? Here's a photo of a one-room schoolhouse. These were amazing places. They were places where people could come together and learn. And they also had these incredible qualities, because they had the qualities of peer-to-peer teaching, where you were grouped together and you didn't necessarily have a ceiling. It wasn't Taylorism. We didn't put students in a box and move them from one box to the next box based on age rather than their learning at that point in time. It was a community that came together to learn. And the problem, though, with the one-room schoolhouse and the problem with the monasteries, which where learning all began a long time ago, used to be the very few would go to the monasteries and learn from those who were well-educated. And then we began to democratize education and spin it out to more and more people. And the one-room schoolhouse was one way, but it couldn't get to scale. And so as we try to believe that knowledge is a public good, and that we try to share that public good with everyone and every person on this planet has a right to have access to that knowledge, we think it's important, obviously, that we spread that knowledge to all. Here I have a photo of MIT, and MIT was one of the first, in many ways, of the open knowledge organizations in the past decade. It was the MIT Open Courseware Project, which really changed the landscape of thinking about how institutions who have historically locked the knowledge within the institution began to share. And MIT now has over 2,000 of its courses freely available online to access, not for credit and not for faculty, but you can see the materials that were previously behind the walled gates of the MIT in the Cambridge. And you can also, if you're a student potentially applying to MIT, you can see what those course materials are. If you're thinking about a class, you can see what those materials are. And if you are going to take the next sequence of a course, you can also use them for review. So this was used not only to open access to knowledge, but it was also used as a teaching and learning. Now the faculty at MIT, even though they may have sat only a few doors down from each other, really understand what's being taught in the course before them. So it began a very early exploration of what open education is. So now we have a whole new world. We have a whole new ecosystem. And the ecosystem blends things that never existed before. We have people. We have computers, and we have the internet. And so we have ways to distribute knowledge much more effectively and much more efficiently than ever before. And in this ecosystem, as we think about our current institutions, we have to say, how do we adapt? How do we change? And how do we evolve as this new system takes place? This is really the open road. We have an open frontier for how we're going to shape our educational systems going forward. I think one thing we all know is that the systems cannot stay unchanged. They will have to evolve with the larger ecosystem. And the question is, how will our higher education institutions evolve, and how will our K-12 system evolve as well? We know for youth today, the world inside the classroom and school looks very, very different from the world in which they live outside. The world they live outside is about Facebook. They have phones, but they don't pick them up. They text each other, right? This is how they get to know each other. They have access to knowledge readily in their hands, and they use this day in and day out. They play games together on the computers, and they're hooked up to each other even though they're in each other's homes. These are the children of today, and the next decade is going to look very, very different. And as we look into how we all operate in the workplace with our different occupations and jobs, we know technology is a huge part of how we communicate with each other, how we share information, how this seminar is being it's being carried to people all over the country and the world who want to see it. And the storage will be there so people who could not physically come here have a chance to access this knowledge. So the world is very different. We have an open frontier. And this is how we need to begin to think about how we step into this ecosystem. And so it was really into this new frontier that Creative Commons came about 10 years ago, because it very quickly saw that the world in which legal of sharing and legal and copyright, what does it mean in this digital age? And how in this digital age can we make sure we're sharing things appropriately within the legal framework of the law when we want to, and how can we send that message to the rest of the world? So as we think of this new space, there's many characteristics. One of them, which is incredibly important, is that it's dynamic. It's changing, and it can change very quickly. And this rapid iteration can be very effective as we think about teaching and learning tools. We can think about collecting data. We can think about student learning and how all of this feeds into the ecosystem. It's also important because it allows open collaboration. It allows us to connect with people who we don't typically always have access to. People in different cultures, different countries, people who have different points of view. It forces us to get together and actually learn and debate, which is the basis of how we move forward. And it also reduces friction. We no longer have to carry the books from one place to another. It allows us to transfer this knowledge very quickly. And as we think about the open internet, what we're thinking about is the free flow of information, of creativity, and of ideas that can rapidly move through the system and evolve. That's where the innovation comes from, where you pick up different ideas and people build on them and you put an idea out. It's why blogs have become so popular, because this is people sharing their ideas and thoughts and letting others respond to them in a very quick way. And another way it reduces friction as we move ahead is we need to be really clear about who owns the copyright to what works and what is the copyright that I can use and how do I know how I use that particular asset. This is really important, and this is particularly important within the publishing world. Usually, it's the publishers who always understood copyright. That was their job. They were creating the works. But now, in this day and age, we're all producers of knowledge. We're not just consumers, we're also producers. And kids today are producers more than anyone else. They're creating videos, they're creating PowerPoint, they're doing blogs, they're doing lots of very exciting stuff in their learning process. And in that process, it's important for them to know how they can legally share. So enter open educational resources. This is an area that's grown over the past 10 years. It grew in many ways from some early investments with the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, but many other foundations have stepped in. And as I step through this, you'll begin to see actually where it's been picked up, certainly by other entities like governments and other organizations as well. So what are open educational resources? They're teaching, learning, and research materials that exist in any medium. They can be in the digital medium, but they can also be print. This is really important for places in the world where they don't have ready access to the internet, particularly in the developing world. And they reside in the public domain. So they carry a public domain license, or if they don't, they can be released under an open license. So the open license is very important. And the open license permits their free use and repurposing by others. So it's not only access. Access is one element, but it's also about remix. It's about redistribution. It's about reuse. And so it's important that as you think about open educational resources, it's free in two ways. And in the open source world, they call it free as in beer, like yes, you can have a free beer, and also free as in freedom. It gives the content that's been created a freedom to be used again and again and to be continually iterated and improved upon. So really to understand open educational resources, to understand open licensing, you really need to understand copyright. And many of us are not lawyers. I myself am not trained as a lawyer. So this is where it gets confusing to individuals who are creators. It gets confusing to institutions and to general counsel within institutions who have typically and long held copyright in a certain frame. Now we have, with the internet, copies everywhere. What do we do with all these copies, and what is the legal way in which we can share? So really to understand this, this is where Creative Commons comes in. So here I'm going to show you a slot, a video. The video talks about Creative Commons. It was in the very early days. It's called Shared Culture. We really grew out of the free culture movement, which was about video bloggers and artists and photographers who really wanted to share their works with others and saw the internet as a way to share and give those permissions. This video was created by Jesse Dillon. It was created for Creative Commons as a birthday gift.
What does it mean to be human if we don't have a shared culture? And what does a shared culture mean if you can't share it?
So it's only in the last 100 or 150 years or so that we've started tightly restricting how that culture gets used.
The internet enabled an infrastructure where anybody could participate without asking permission.
We have all these new technologies that allow people to express themselves, take control of their own creative impulses, but the law is getting in the way.
Creative Commons is designed to save the world from failed sharing. People who actually want to share stuff, who put it up on the web because they want to share it on certain terms. So we wanted to create a simple way for creators to say to the world, here's the freedom that I want to run with my creative work. Here are the things you're allowed to do. Can I reproduce it? Can I copy it? Can I put it in my textbook? Can I use that photograph? Can I make a new version of it?
Creative Commons gives tools to creators to make a choice about copyright.
Creative Commons license can cover anything that copyright covers.
Every license says, you need to give me attribution. I created this, give me credit for the work I did.
The basic choices are commercial use or not. Can you make derivative works, versions, adaptations, or not? And do you want me to have to share alike? So if I take your stuff, do I have to offer it to the next person under the same terms?
There's no requirement for you to do anything with your work other than what you want to do. You own the copyright to it. What we've done is given you the right to exercise your copyright in more ways, more simply.
So the idea here is to enable that creative impulses that the technology turns loose and get the law out of the way.
The work of Creative Commons is really about laying the infrastructure groundwork for this new type of culture, a new kind of folk culture.
Somebody from Delhi, somebody from New York, somebody from Singapore
can feel comfortable using a photo that was created and given away by someone in the United States or in China or wherever that the licenses have been extended to.
With their identity being preserved.
Which means that people can actually create new kinds of things, come together and build things.
Mashups that people can do with people's Flickr photos.
And CC Mixer has allowed artists to make music together.
It's really about creativity and connection.
Access and control.
From amateurs who simply for the love of what they're doing and they want to share it and they want other people to be able to make use of it, to commercial organizations.
In the end, this will have a very successful place in the for-profit economy.
Creative Commons is this bridge to this future. Is you got to move away from thinking about content to thinking about communities. Communities that develop around content. And the sharing that the licenses allow enable these communities to come together.
A physical commons is like a park where anybody can enter equally. The commons with intellectual works is actually much freer.
It really is going to be the pillar for communications between people, cultural exchange.
The space for more speech, more free expression.
And that's the kind of commons we're trying to create.
That gives you a sense of the larger picture of Creative Commons and the idea about free culture and preserving our cultural heritage as well. So in many ways, as we think about Creative Commons, we're the bit of the infrastructure. We're the roadwork. We are the platform upon which open licensing can exist and that people can build and innovate on because this open license exists and people know that there are parameters in which they can work. Creative Commons is an organization that's housed in Silicon Valley. We have about 25 employees, but our larger network is our affiliates who are across the globe. The license has been ported to over 70 countries and jurisdictions, and in those countries and jurisdictions, we have over 100 affiliates who are volunteers, who believe in the mission of open sharing and open licensing, and work in their local area to promote the opportunities that open licensing affords. So our reach is extensive. We have a global network. And as a result of that, Creative Commons and open licensing is becoming clearly the global standard. This slide's a little bit old. It hasn't quite been updated yet. But at about last year, we were at about 400 million assets that have been licensed under a Creative Commons license. As of most recently, the close of the year, we're at about 500 million access. And you can see that there's a distribution between the total license works and those that are under buy, share alike, or in the public domain. And I can get into those details a little bit more. But those are the least restrictive license, which allow the infusion and mix of different types of content and different forms of content overall. Our licenses are unique because they're expressed in three ways, and this is really important, clearly, in the digital age. They're expressed in a lawyer-readable legal code that has been developed by legal scholars in this country and across the globe. The legal code is something that your general counsels and your institutions would read and understand and feel comfortable that this is a legal document. It has been enforced in courts across the world. It has been upheld in every instance in which it has happened. So it is a license of use. The human readable deed is something that you and I can read. So we can easily, as we are now all creators and producers, begin to understand how we share our content materials. It makes it very clear to me what permissions I, as the creator, am giving away and giving to others to use. And importantly, there's a machine readable metadata. And the machine readable metadata is important because this is HTML code that allows search engines to be able to find openly licensed content and materials so that others who want to use whatever you have built, that you have given the permission, can find and locate those materials. To talk a little bit about some of the work we're doing in higher education, particularly is the Trade Adjustment Assistance Community College and Career Training Program. This is the Department of Labor and Department of Education's $2 billion infusion into community colleges for workforce development. As part of this grant program, they're requiring that all products of the grants carry a Creative Commons by license, so that in each of the four ways, $500 million of funding has been granted. It's currently, the proposals have been accepted. The launch actually is next week in D.C., and I will be there. And this is now the opportunity for community colleges in particular, but many consortium of community colleges and other entities who are creating materials to actually not only to create it for themselves, but put it out for the broader community to use. And you can use it as is if you see what you like, but you can also just use pieces of it that you like. You can improve upon it, and you can revise it and remix it. So this is now going to create an incredible infusion of content into the education systems. And we know in the community college systems in this country, 47% of students attend community colleges in this country. So this will have a very significant impact on the ability of the colleges to use resources that continually go into content development in other ways that those institutions would like to. The community college content can also go down into K-12, which is really interesting in the higher schools. It can also go up into some of the early introductory courses at some of the other four-year institutions. This is where the flow of information across the internet is really important, and how we begin to think about the different pieces and put them together in a coherent and pedagogically strong package for students to use. This is a project we're doing, and I want to make sure I note, with Carnegie Mellon Open Learning Initiative, where they have really refined the process of data analytics and being able to really track the footprints of students as they use their materials. They'll be working also with the community college to infuse some of their best practices. We'll be working with the community colleges to make sure they understand what open licensing is, to make sure the IP clearance is done properly, and so that we can inform them and provide technical assistance. The other group that we're working with is CAST, which is a group of Universal Design for Learning, which is out of Massachusetts. They really understand accessibility. And so, again, we have learned some very strong best practices. And in this opportunity of the content development, we want to make sure that these services were available to the grant award winners. And lastly, the Washington State Board of Community Technical Colleges is working with us as well, because they've been able to operationalize some of their work in open licensing and open content throughout the state and have expertise on how best to use professional development to do that. This other project is a Learning Resources Metadata Initiative, and this is a partnership between Creative Commons and the Association of Educational Publishers. And this is to create the metadata standards for education. Right now, when education content is developed, we all use different metadata standards. There are many that have been floating around. They've been there for a long time. We as a community have not come to agreement about the metadata standards. So we're working and bringing together the technical advisory group. We're doing this in partnership. This is for all educational materials, whether free or for fee, but we need to be able to discover the content. We need to be able to discover the gems. In the internet, it is a bit chaotic out there. When the end user is looking for a certain piece of content, it is very, very difficult to find. And so this project is beginning to put out what the metadata standards can be. We'll pass them on to an organization called schema.org. The schema.org will be like a holding place where the search engines can decide whether they will actually pick up those metadata standards that are put forth by the community. But this gives us a chance to coalesce. This gives us a chance to move forward, and this gives us a chance for the gems of educational content to be found. I just wanted to mention Blackboard. Blackboard recently announced a few months ago that it was integrating open licensing into their platform, so that they're beginning to hear the demand that faculty want to be able to both integrate Creative Commons materials and open license materials, and faculty sometimes also want to be able to document that their materials, they're interested in sharing them with the larger world. So this is also part of Creative Commons by license, and we're beginning to see more platforms begin to adopt the Creative Commons license, because the world of private and public, of free and open, are beginning to blend together. Washington's Open Course Library, for those of you who may not know of it, is a collection of openly licensed educational materials. It's for the 81 high enrollment college courses. The project goals were really to lower, obviously, the textbook cost for students, to improve the course completion rates, and provide new resources for faculty. So Washington legislators decided if the public funds in Washington were being used to create these materials, wouldn't it be nice if they were actually openly licensed? And then it could transfer across the public institutions within Washington. It could actually move beyond Washington to California and to other locations. And others can build and improve again on these course materials. And Washington State will again benefit through those improvements, but will also get very strong distributed model. Open courseware overall, I mentioned that MIT was one of the first institutions that adopted open courseware. There are now over 200 institutions, which is called in the Open Courseware Consortium. These institutions are in the United States, but mostly actually around the world. Content has been translated into multiple languages. It's over 10,000 courses that are now available, and this is beginning to, the benefits of actually sharing the content are clearly understood by the institutions who are participating. So we're about 10 years into that event. The OpenStack College, I just wanted to note that this is a new project that's just released. It's a project between Connections and Rice University, and Google has also been involved with it as well, but it's providing some open textbooks, and the textbooks are going to be very, very high quality, and the idea is to really make sure that in the high enrollment courses we have some very high quality textbooks that can easily be distributed and that can continue to evolve and iterate. And when these textbooks are developed, I should say they're very flexible. They're modular. You can take chapters if you want. You don't have to. You can insert your own material if you're a faculty member. And as we think about the evolution of a textbook, we can, early on as we thought about it, well, when does a textbook become a course and when is a course a textbook? Right? And how do we begin to actually think about new language that we'd likely use? Originally, in the digital age, we would take a textbook and we just put it up online. So it was the print version that you could now read online. And before we had our Kindles and everything else, it was very difficult to read a book on a computer. It's just hard on your eyes. But as we also think about these courses going forward, we can think about the embedded assessments, right? We know they'll have simulations. They'll have linked to videos. The students can take notes. Can imagine that there could be collaborative spaces with the textbook. So as a student's reading around different material, studying a certain module, they can find someone else out in the space who's also working on that as well and ask questions and getting to an evolution. So we know the books are going to become very dynamic. We know this is the way we're moving. And so a textbook will become a course, and then what will a course really be? I think we'll have to think about that. But there'll be new language that we'll have to develop. Flat World Knowledge, I just wanted to note, is a for-profit open textbook model. They are young, smart folks. I don't know if any of them are here. Come from the publishing world, began to understand what open licensing was about, understood kind of the disaggregation of the model, began to think about how are there new ways in which we can distribute high-quality textbooks, and they've just been phenomenally successful. Peer-to-peer university. So there's new models emerging as we think about education. So we have our current structure of educational systems, but there's also new models that people are beginning to test out. One of them is called peer-to-peer university, where you can learn anything with your peers. What it doesn't have is accreditation, right? We know accreditation is really important. It's a signal in our society. It's a signal for the workplace. So what are these alternative forms of accreditation that are arising? There's badging systems that are coming out, kind of going back to our Boy Scout, Girl Scout days. This badging system where you tie it to competencies and you tie it to knowledge. And if you can now access these materials freely available on the world, and we can access tons of material on the internet, how do I, as a learner who may not be in a formal institution, how do I show my competency in that knowledge? And how do I think about that going forward? So these new forms of accreditation, the badging systems are being tested out. One in particular, which is not a typical space for higher education, is the Mozilla organization, which brings us Firefox, has created a school of webcraft, right? People who want to learn how to play on the web and code can't actually learn that effectively within traditional higher ed institutions. Technology is changing too fast. So they've developed a school of webcraft. We're developing a school of open. So people who want to learn about openness, who want to learn about copyright, who want to learn about Creative Commons license, can go to the peer-to-peer university and have access to this materials and content, can engage with other peers, and we can create certifications for that to happen. I also want to mention, as we know, we're working in a much larger world, right? We're talking about the education system, but it's in the larger social media space. I talked about Flat World Knowledge. Flickr was an early photo site that used the Creative Commons license. Wikipedia content is licensed with the Creative Commons license. That's what allows people to remix, to reuse. And so all the assets on Wikipedia are licensed under Creative Commons. SoundCloud as well as Vimeo. So these are music, these are video sites as well. And as we think about the internet, YouTube is another one which actually just adopted last year, which I should have up on that slide, a big platform, right? So as kids now or people upload into YouTube, you can easily check a box of whether you want to use the Creative Commons license. So as we think about platforms are really an easy place to be for people to understand the terms of service, to understand what the copyright is. And we've been working with many of the platforms and the emerging platforms because because this is a choice that users want to have. And as we think about the internet in general, though, we want to make sure the content doesn't get siloed, because the next phase for the internet isn't just the videos in one place and the photos in another and the music sitting in another repository. Just like in open education, in many ways, we have textbooks sitting in one place and lesson plans sitting in another and simulations sitting in another place. But how do we think about the remix and the mashup of all of that different content? And how do we make sure that when we pull something from one repository to another, when we put it together, that we can have the appropriate license? This is going to be the next wave. This is going to be where the whole system of the internet is moving. And as we think about education, we need to think about what is our play as we think about the future of the internet. The White House uses a Creative Commons license, so those who contribute to openwhitehouse.gov are openly licensing their comments so other people can reblog. This is very typical in the blogging space. So we kind of have this cloud right now. The cloud is where all our data is going. The cost is getting driven to zero. This is not the early days of the internet when everything was so incredibly expensive and it was very, very difficult to both access to host. And as we think about it, I think the important piece, particularly around the cloud, is what we do now with all this data. This is a piece that's really just being discovered in some ways. There's a lot of data being created. How do we track what's happening with student knowledge and competencies? How can we learn from the data and quickly iterate to actually improve the materials? How do we know what students' prerequisite knowledge and skills were? And how can we also understand what content and services would work best for them, for that individual, that personal person that, who has a unique skill set? When we think about the box, and I think about K-12 a little bit, the box, we go in first grade, we go in second grade, we move along, and in most cases, 95 or maybe 98% of us just move along in that box. It doesn't matter if you can really excel and you can move much quicker. And so we have the extraordinarily bright students who are bored, and then we have students who do not have some of the fundamentals who struggle, and they have passed each year from box to box, and they do not catch up because there is no way a single teacher with all those students can serve those students well. We have set a system up that is failing the teacher, that is failing the students, and it is constraining the top students. And so we teach to the middle as best as we can, and there are phenomenal teachers out there who do this. But this is, we put them under the most difficult conditions and expect them to excel. We do this also as we think about some of the students who are in community colleges. This is the school of second chance, where again, there's a huge diversity and range in students. And we try to replicate the same mistakes that we've made in earlier parts of our educational system. But we now have an opportunity to personalize. We now have an opportunity to use technology to serve our students much better than we ever have before. This is not to say technology is the panacea. Technology is one part of the solution, but technology with data about students, about what works and what's effective, is what we can use every day as we begin to make the lesson plans and to try to determine what is best for that individual student to be personalized. We know as we come through these systems, what we want is lifelong learners. We know we are all going to have to be lifelong learners. And we know the next generation are going to have 7 to 10 jobs within the first 15 years of their life. Those of us who have had pretty much set careers, I've had a few long runs. That may be unlikely for the next generation. That is not how they will be moving and assimilating information moving ahead. And so the world has changed. We have the technology. We know how to do this. We know how to drive down cost, and yet we haven't embraced it yet. So as we think about this, we need to think about how we are going to move into this day and not resist the change, because the change is here. The genie is out of the bottle. And the question is, how do we embrace the genie as we move forward? This goes really to this conversation about how do we use feedback loops to improve our pedagogy, how we can improve our scholarship for each individual student. So this is from Carnegie Mellon, their Open Learning Initiative. This is the killer app, right? This is the holy grail. And if we can make this work for our students, we should be able to see much higher levels of productivity and growth. So we have the student in the middle. It's all about the student and their learning data. And there's an instructor who always is engaging the student in different ways. The student, the instructor, you know, intervenes at the right moments. They can do it in very personalized ways, and they can engage that individual. Course design is really critical as well. We have to still understand what are the learning objectives? What is the appropriate sequence for the learning objectives to make sure that we move ahead? We have to always be looking at student performance, so those who are excelling can continue to move ahead. Those who are struggling can be scaffolded. And they can be scaffolded in the moment if you use technology. Students who don't understand a concept of supply and demand, as an example, can be scaffolded for their learning or rerouted back to some fundamental knowledge so that they can just recall it. It can also be presented in multiple formats. We learn in different ways. And so this opportunity gives us the opportunity to really scaffold the learning for each individual. And we also need to bring in the science of learning about what we know about brain plasticity, how we know what we've learned about neuroscience, what we've learned about how students engage and how students perform and how we learn at a very deep level. I just also wanted to note, as we think about higher education, we think about open educational resource, there's been long growing movement around the open access movement. Science, scientific knowledge, this is what gets produced in many of the higher education institutions. There's a new era in publishing. Publishing is much more happening within the open access movement, and this is becoming more and more the norm, particularly as young faculty are coming through the system. There are over 1,800 CC-licensed open access journals, so the knowledge that is getting created in our public institutions is going back out into the public, so it doesn't have these long, long cycles of delay in publishing. This is upsetting the model, the existing model of publishing and journaling, but again, we have to think about something new. I'm not saying that there's one right way and there's one wrong way, but having a long lag to public knowledge that has been created in the pace of change of what's happening is not okay. We can do better. So we have to figure out a new model to get that information out that the public has paid for, allow the public to have access to that knowledge. Europeana, just to think about some of the other activities going on in other parts of the world, this is a group of museums and archives and cultural artifacts. They have adopted the Creative Commons tool as well. They've put out the metadata so that these content and materials can be found. This I just wanted to note that there's quite a bit of legislation pending in the open policy space, in the open licensing space. Just a few examples in California. I was in Sacramento last week providing technical assistance. There's a bill pending in the higher education system that would make $25 million available to be put out as an RFP for textbooks. And it would allow current publishers' traditional models of publishing to compete for the right to develop the textbooks, but also allow open models as well. But the difference is in this bill is that any content that's created using the federal funds would actually be licensed by the state. So the state would have ownership. And the state would then be able to use an open license, which could be the Creative Commons license, so that down the road, those textbooks and materials that are published don't have to be started from scratch again and again. And it does cost a fair amount to develop a high quality initial content element, whether it's a textbook, a simulation, course modules. You want to develop the best. We want to make sure they are of the highest quality for our students. But because of the digital age, the replication of that and the tweaking and the maintenance of that does not have to be high. We do not have to continually start from scratch. There are more efficient models and more efficient ways that we could use that funding. So under that particular bill, if passed, it would allow open licensing to compete with the traditional publishers. They should put the contract out. They will go through a very significant scrutination process. And it should go to whoever can develop the best product at the best cost. And then the public, who has paid for those assets, should have access to them down the road. So this is really important as we think about open licensing. There's also a Free Research Public Access Act that just got introduced at the federal level just within the past few days. And this, again, is encouraging public institutions of scientific knowledge and journals within 6 months to put those journals and articles out in an open system. The National Institute of Health has already done this, and it has become a model. But again, now that's a bipartisan support of leaders in this country who are saying that the public who pays for this materials and access should have access to them down the road. This you can find on our Creative Commons website. Sometimes it's difficult to understand some of the stories. This is a really great collection of about 30 stories of people around the world and organizations who have adopted the Creative Commons license. We have Patrick McAndrew here from Open University UK. He's in the book, and he talks about how the open license was used at the Open University. So they actually looked in their early day of looking into open education, were trying to decide whether they needed to create their own license. And they looked into it, and then they realized a strong license was already created, and it's become the standard. And what we want to make sure is that licenses interoperate with each other, because if he created his own license, and I created my own, and you created yours, then the end user who wants to take a little bit of what you've created, and a little bit of what Patrick's created, and a little bit of what I created, can't figure it out. It's just way too confusing. So one of the most important things is that we have the standards for these licenses, that they are clearly understood, that they're interoperable, so we're not creating silos. And this book gives a story of musicians and institutions who have adopted the license. And you begin to see what the effect and the reach of it is overall. So in the end, we want to reduce redundancy. We don't always need to start from scratch. We need to get beyond that headset, right? Math hasn't changed that much. I was a math undergrad. Calculus is calculus, right? It doesn't change that much. And so we can really develop some incredible content and materials, and we can put them up on the internet, and we can have the access be readily available. You know, and if it's a print form or a digital version of a textbook, the marginal cost for each additional copy approaches zero. We can share these assets across states. We can share them across students as we begin to reach out to students across the world. We do not need to continually build again and again. Serendipity also plays a role here. You can find knowledge. You can find people tinkering on the edge. You can find faculty who are doing incredible things. I mean, I think in the development of the open educational resources field early on, one of the most important things we did at the foundation is we brought together people we were finding who were working on really fascinating things but didn't know about each other. And so we actually physically at that time brought them together. But this is this huge connection of people finding each other in different parts of the world and sharing and extending and building in ways that just can't happen when you're working alone. And it is disruptive. This is a bit of a disruptive innovation. Clay Christensen talks about anything that goes into the digital age becomes a product of disruption. And in higher education, education is in this disruptive phase. So the question is, how do we embrace it? How do we modify it? And how do we step it in a way where we can evolve it as it moves ahead? But most importantly, when we have this digital age, when we have the internet, when we have openness, and we have this world that's operating all around us, we have the ability to go to scale in a way that we've never done before. And this is really important. Because initially, Open Educational Resources always had two clear goals. The first goal was about leveling the playing field. Because we can't all get to MIT, we can't all get to the Ivory Gates, we can't be at the most exclusive institutions, but every person should have access to high-quality content and materials. That is part of being a democracy. That is part of our democratization and the process of which we believe in. And this ability to scale so that every student has access to that kind of materials is incredibly important. That's one goal. That's a precondition for the second goal. The second goal is really about improving teaching and learning. We still need to embrace this clearly, and we need to learn how we do this in the digital age. I know there's been incredible meetings and conferences and panel sessions all week. You're all doing it all the time, every day. But we really have to learn as a community. We have to share those learnings with each other, and we have to continue to evolve our system. Education as an industry is flatlined. We have not shown increase in productivity. That's what we're not creating widgets. And as we think about it, we really need to think about how do we embrace technology so that we can engage many more and we can move through some of the constraints and bottlenecks of our current system. And let me just say, in California, we have students who cannot get into the community colleges. There are not enough seats. And technology can solve that problem. It's not going to solve the whole problem of education for students in California. But some of those students could take online classes. They could be very high-quality materials. They can engage with other students. They can have mentors who are online. They can even have some physical contact at a very low cost if they needed it. And then they should be able to take a test and show competency because they have been able to collect that knowledge and information. And we don't have a way to do that. So we have to wait for them physically to get in the door. And then, as we know, many students don't get out certainly in 4 years. They're five and a half years. They can't get into the courses, right? There's a way that technology can begin to solve that problem. It doesn't replace the 4-year experience or the 2-year experience or the importance of the face-to-face contact, but it's a way to bring in another element to begin to solve these problems. And so this is about scale. This is about reach. This is about access. This is about making sure that every student in this country has access to the best education possible. I wanted to make sure I noted that Open Education Week, the first Open Education Week, is happening next month, March 5th to 10th. This is the broad community of people and institutions working across the globe on open education. It's around open educational resources, open access, open data, open policies, open licensing. There'll be webinars. It'll be a 24/7 event as it spirals around the world. And it's something that I wanted to make sure acknowledge. The Open Courseware Consortium has really put together, along with Google, who is helping us to publicize it. And so this is something that we can all kind of engage and learn in as we move ahead. With that, there is a public footpath, and I hope to encourage you all to engage in it, to step into the space of openness and open licensing, to figure out what works for you within your system, and to not necessarily think it has to be an either or. These two systems are not mutually exclusive, but they can be beneficial. And so the objective is to really think about what parts of your institution could you potentially step into this idea of openness and begin to explore and begin to learn. And in that process, I have found again and again and again that once institutions step in and see that their business model doesn't fall apart, or actually it has these spurious benefits that they didn't even realize could happen, that they begin to understand the power of openness, the power of engagement, and the power of open licensing. With that, let me close by saying that this PowerPoint is openly licensed. Feel free to reuse, remix at any time. And thank you very much for your attention. I know we have some time for questions. Thank you.
I've got a question that came in through IdeaScale. Somebody's actually making a suggestion about whether or not Creative Commons has thought about working more with kind of high-profile individuals and organizations, world-famous artists, intellectuals, as well as publishers of every kind to license their work. Through Creative Commons, the thought is that that might help with the PR of Creative Commons a little bit and draw attention to it.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Absolutely. We just had our staff in from around the globe last week, and we did a brainstorm for our 10th birthday is the end of this year. And so engaging with some very highly visible celebrities and personalities is clearly important. In the early days, we did have some early bands that have adopted. We still have more. But I think as we think about the different sectors of our space, there are kind of the go-to people and the marquee people, and I think bringing them in are critically important. And I just note that I'll throw his name out since he's adopted our licenses, is Carl Wineman. He's a Nobelist in physics. He was an early grantee around open educational resources. He has these great physics simulations and science simulations that are available. Not that many people know about it, but because of his stature, he can really bring that into play. So we do, I welcome that suggestion and think that's exactly right. And I think, well, certainly for me, I come from an academic perspective, you know, the economics of education, not marketing or management. It's hard in the education space. This isn't what we do. We don't go out and sell. You know, this isn't really the role that we typically play. And so as we move into the space, we do really need to think about our reach and our brand, which is why we have brought in, particular across the globe, affiliates who carry both legal, technical, and communication knowledge as well.
You talked a little bit. About some legislation, including the Federal Research Public Access Act.
Correct.
Could you talk a little bit about the status of the Research Works Act and other legal threats to open access?
So the there were a few that have been floating in the ecosystem, which you might be well aware. One was the SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy. So that was it became very well known, particularly when Wikipedia put a blackout and Google put a bit of a blackout on their site. And that was really about constraining the ability of content to flow and who is responsible for the content and management overall. So when someone uploads something and it is not appropriately copyrighted, who has the right and responsibility to make sure that stays down? Right now, just so people know, there's a safe harbor. Anytime content is put up on a site that's inappropriate and you're notified of it, you have 24 hours to investigate and to take it down. That then doesn't constrain us from having the ability to put materials as appropriate in different places and in different silos. With respect to the acts, the new act that just came into play, the Free Research Public Access Act, is taking place of the original one before it. So there has been a hold on the earlier policy, and this is kind of the new version of the bill that's moving forward.
Kathy, I was recently speaking to the federal government in Canada about open, and they're very interested and see it as a means of saving money. But one of the major questions they had was, beyond saving money, to what extent can it play a role in driving the economy? And I wonder if you want to speak to some of the ways you see open as an economic driver.
Yeah, I think it's about the value chain. And I think it's clearly about the business models and innovation. So when we think about economic drivers, and as the country is thinking about it, particularly this country, given we're in election year, the economic drivers are around education, making sure we have a fully trained and well-skilled workforce. It's about innovation, because innovation creates jobs. And it's thinking about the larger ecosystem in this way of creativity. So as we think about the value of openness, there are, I think it's that open road I showed to a certain extent. We don't know what all the business models will be, but we know that they will come, because a lot of these organizations that I showed, Flickr and YouTube, when we even started Creative Commons, none of them existed, right? These are all new entities, social media, Facebook, Twitter, right? This is all new space. And I think as we think about education, I think it's really thinking about how education gets blended into those spaces and what some of the value opportunities are, and thinking about the innovation as well. So what I think will happen is we're going to have parallel systems in some ways. You have the current educational systems and structures. We've had new ones that have been emerging. We know that there's been distance and online learning. There's going to be more and more of that happens. There are going to be probably some blended models, which will be pretty important. And I think there will also be a way of how do we think about the seamlessness of life in 10 years. Kids are getting all their information on Facebook, or whatever the new Facebook is. It'll be a new Facebook. It won't be Facebook, right? First, it was Second Life. You know, we were setting classes up in Second Life and trying to figure out what the business model was in there. Well, that's not quite there anymore. This will continue to evolve, and there will be different, I think, ideas emerging, and I think part of the unknown is what will be that great idea. Who can see what that future of the internet looks like, and how can they put together some of these blended models that I think will help all.
So please join with me in thanking Catherine for her presentation. Catherine.
This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.